A new government report estimates a record number of Americans are experiencing homelessness.
Can you be held criminally liable for a scenario that you can't avoid, i.e. living in an area where there aren't any other options other than living on the streets?
Supreme Court is going to weigh in on whether local officials can legally ban people from camping in public spaces.
The petition filed Tuesday asked SCOTUS to reverse a 2018 Ninth Circuit court ruling, which specifically prohibits states and cities from outlawing urban and homeless encampments unless the community has enough shelter beds to house those who need it.
Last month, the Supreme Court announced that it'll be hearing a case in April that will have serious lasting impacts on the way that cities across the country manage the current homelessness crisis. The announcement about Grants Pass v. Johnson flew largely under the radar, but its implications are widespread and could have devastating consequences for people experiencing homelessness from LA to New York City and everywhere in between. But Grants Pass is just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the ways in which we regulate homelessness in this country. Instead of passing laws that provide support to people clearly in a housing crisis, municipalities, states, and federal agencies pass regulations that largely criminalize an entire population for not being able to find housing. This criminalization then pushes them further into the periphery of society. But it's a crisis that's become impossible to ignore, not only in large coastal cities, but also here in the Midwest and even in rural parts of the country as well. As cities begin to buckle under the weight of the homelessness crisis, they're turning to ever more draconian measures, not to try to help the people who need it most, but instead to more effectively brush them under the rug so they're easier to ignore. If Trump wins in November, he's suggested sending the homeless to internment camps on land no one wants. Sound familiar? From hostile architecture to outlawing camping, this is how the United States criminalizes homelessness. Thank you to Factor for partnering with me on today's video. I've been trying to hit the gym lately, and I have to meal plan every week so that I can keep on track with my goals, but meal planning is really hard, and Factor makes it way easier. They deliver fresh, never frozen, dietitian-approved meals right to your doorstep. And they have a team of gourmet chefs, so that when you order Factor, that means you also have a team of gourmet chefs. That's so fancy. You'll have over 35 different options to choose from every week, including keto, vegetarian, and more, so you can easily plan your meals no matter your goals. I recently tried this cheesy garden herb chicken, and it was creamy and delicious. They also have breakfast snacks, smoothies, and these delicious little wellness shots, so they have you covered for every meal of the day. And there's no prep and no mess, and I have ADHD, and so I need that very much. Thank you. Head to factor75.com or click the link below and use code LEJA50 to get 50% off your first box and free wellness shots for life. You get two free wellness shots from three available flavors for every order while you're an active subscriber. Fun! Thanks, Factor. The city of Grants Pass, Oregon, is home to approximately 38,000 residents, 600 of whom are unhoused. This number exceeds the available shelter beds in the small town, requiring some people to sleep on the streets or in parks. But the Grants Pass Municipal Code bars them from doing so, including anti-sleeping and anti-camping ordinances that apply civil fines against anyone in violation of the law. If left unpaid, those fines can turn into criminal penalties. The case coming before the Supreme Court in Grants Pass v. Johnson is a class-action lawsuit brought to challenge the constitutionality of the Grants Pass Municipal Code. And this isn't a novel legal concept, it's squarely based on established case law set in September 2018 when the Ninth Circuit decided in Martin v. City of Boise that the Eighth Amendment prohibits the imposition of criminal penalties for sitting, sleeping, or lying outside on public property for homeless individuals who cannot obtain shelter. The Eighth Amendment, as a reminder, protects against cruel and unusual punishment. The argument being that if a city does not have the appropriate number of shelter beds for people experiencing homelessness, then punishing them for doing the things necessary for sustaining life, like sleeping, is cruel and unusual punishment. The Ninth Circuit found in favor of the class of involuntarily unhoused people in Grants Pass v. Johnson, and now the Supreme Court has decided to hear the case to make a final decision, a surprising choice given that the Supreme Court typically prefers hearing cases regarding issues that the circuit courts are split over. There is no disagreement among the circuits on this issue, and many decisions in other parts of the country have been based in agreement on the original Martin v. v. Boise decision from 2018. The Supreme Court may side with the Ninth Circuit and agree that banning people from publicly doing the activities necessary for sustaining life while offering them no means by which to do so privately, aka shelter beds, violates their constitutional right to be free from cruel and unusual punishment. The Boise decision was narrowly tailored to apply only to individuals experiencing involuntary homelessness, doing those activities necessary to sustain life, and only in situations where there are no shelter beds available. So if someone is camping in the park and has a house or there are shelter beds available for them, they wouldn't be protected. But detractors argue that this is not a constitutional issue at all. This should be left to the states to decide how to manage the homeless population, and the Eighth Amendment doesn't apply here. They also argue that people who can't find shelter beds could just leave and go elsewhere. They're not trapped in the city, so there's nothing cruel or unusual about it. They need to just buck up and go somewhere else. As you'll see as we discuss the issue of criminalizing homelessness, the theme of just making people go away is prevalent in all of the so-called solutions proposed by those outside of the community who actually serve this population. One reason why the Supreme Court likely agreed to take this issue up is because of the number of cities, including nominally liberal ones, who are asking them to get rid of these restrictions. Some judges argue too that Boise and now Grants Pass have tied the hands of city officials who are trying to manage a growing homelessness problem. Though I have yet to see a compelling argument as to how barring people from existing in public while unhoused is actually an effective way to fix the problem. But that's the thing. Cities aren't trying to fix the problem. They're trying to make it go away by any means necessary. A Supreme Court decision in favor of Grants Pass, one that says it's not unconstitutional to ban people from camping or sleeping in public, would open the door for increased policing of unhoused individuals and destruction of encampments that have sprung up in response to the desperate need for housing. It could also open the door for cities to forcibly remove involuntarily unhoused people to designated areas or forcibly send them to substance use or psychiatric treatment programs against their will. This has profound implications for a community of people who are already vulnerable and whose ranks have been growing steadily in recent years. A report issued at the end of 2023 indicated that there had been a 12% increase in homelessness since 2022. A reported 653,000 people were homeless, the highest number since the country began recording in 2007. Prior to COVID, homelessness had been on a gradual decline across the country. In 2021 and 2022, homelessness levels generally flattened as people benefited from COVID relief measures like moratoriums on evictions and pauses on student loan debt. But in 2023, those moratoriums lifted, the pauses stopped, and the devastation that had been staved off by government programs accelerated at jarring speeds. The combination of lost income, backlogs of owed rent, and a lack of government foresight led to a surge of people ending up on the streets. And much of the increase was in people becoming homeless for the very first time in their lives. And we'll get into the housing shortage, but increase in housing costs combined with severe inflation means that literally half of all renters, 22.4 million households, can't technically afford their rent under the accepted standard that paying more than 30% of your income on rent renders that rent technically unaffordable. Add to that the fact that fully 63% of working adults say they wouldn't be able to cover a $500 emergency. And you have an unprecedented portion of the population that, if they aren't already homeless, are one emergency or missed paycheck away from being there. And the numbers only tell a very small portion of the reality of the housing crisis. Not only is it extremely difficult to pinpoint the exact number of people out on the streets every night due to the transient nature of their existence, the number of people sleeping in the streets or in shelters is only a small portion of the people in the United States who don't have a home to go to. People who are living in motels or are couch surfing in the homes of friends and family aren't considered homeless. And often, people will stay on the street until they can save up enough to spend a night in a motel, and then they're back on the streets again. Often, parents will live in shelters and on the streets while their unhoused children stay with friends and family. The nature of the homelessness problem is incredibly complex, and each person experiencing homelessness is trying to survive using whatever means necessary, making them hard to trace. And the cycle is incredibly difficult to break. Someone sleeping on the street, in their friend's living room, in a hotel they can't afford, they have to constantly be thinking about where they'll get their next meal and how they'll get a hold of some money to find a place to stay the next night. They also are often vulnerable to attack and assault, both when living on the street, but also if they're in abusive situations that they can't leave for fear of ending up on the street. Sleeping in a car or on a couch provides little comfort, making it hard to function day to day. The cost of the rental unit alone needed to store their belongings after losing their home can become insurmountable. When you live on the street, where do you store your clothes so you can look clean and presentable if you do have a job?
job? How can you show up to work and be effective if you don't know where you're going to sleep that night? How can you get a job to begin with if you haven't had access to a shower in a month? Children living in these situations often struggle with school and interpersonal relationships because of the lack of housing stability. The draw of semi-permanent encampments for unhoused people is the relative stability that those encampments provide. A place to return to every night that provides shelter, a community of people who don't shame you for not having housing, and often access to resources from community groups who are able to set up facilities within the encampments. Encampments can also be unsafe, and sleeping in a tent doesn't provide the security that sleeping behind a locked door can provide, but they offer a sense of stability that other options, including temporary shelters, can't. The reality, of course, is that a tent isn't a home, and encampments aren't or shouldn't be a permanent solution to the crisis we're currently facing. But the reason that encampments have been popping up in cities across the country is because they're often the best option among a slew of bad options. And when cities spend time and resources to demolish these encampments instead of addressing the underlying problems, they're not just making it go away. The tents will continue to pop up in other places until we actually do something about this already. And when you look at this cycle of homelessness, where it can be incredibly difficult to come back from becoming homeless because the hardships often snowball beyond one person's control, you can imagine the additional strain that criminalization would add to an already horrible situation. Not only do you have the cost of a rental unit to hold your personal items until you can get back on your feet, but now you have a fine to pay because you broke the city ordinance against sleeping outside. You can't pay that fine, so it becomes a criminal penalty. Now you have a criminal record, making it even more difficult to find a job or rent an apartment because of mandatory background checks. Criminalization is the exacerbation of an already horrible problem, and that is why attorneys for the plaintiffs in Grants Pass v. Johnson are arguing that these ordinances amount to cruel and unusual punishment. It's the ultimate salt in the wound, kicking people when they're already down. The way that we treat people experiencing homelessness is inhumane, and I think one day we will look back on their treatment aghast at how society could ever be so cruel and draconian. Unfortunately, we're not at that day yet, and in fact, we have made very little progress in the centuries since industrialization pushed people into cities and created modern-day homelessness as we know it. Criminalization of homelessness has existed at the state level for centuries. Victorian-era vagrancy laws were written so broadly that they were applied to generally any behavior that a cop in that moment might deem suspicious or offensive. They included having no visible lawful means of support, begging, consorting, and occupying public places at night without a lawful excuse. This also included the criminalization of sex work and of cross-dressing, or generally seeming a little too gay for comfort. Debtors' prisons were a common way to herd poor people into cells until their debts were repaid. Victorian-era vagrancy laws gave way to Jim Crow laws at the turn of the 20th century, criminalizing black people for generally existing in a way that a white person at any given moment may decide they didn't like. And indeed, to this day, the criminalization of homelessness is aimed at BIPOC and LGBTQ communities at rates that far surpass the white heteronormative homeless community. However, with the onset of the Great Depression and the commencement of World War II, as part of the New Deal, the government financed the aggressive construction of homes to combat a lack of housing, and the Federal Housing and Urban Development Agency was later founded during the administration of Lyndon B. Johnson to build and rehabilitate millions of housing units. Of course, due to racist zoning laws, restrictive covenants, and federally mandated racist apportionment of government housing resources during and after the New Deal, many of the most vulnerable people still didn't receive much of these benefits. But at the very least, the federal government took some role and responsibility in addressing housing and the housing shortages in this country. And then one man came along, and he saw what HUD was doing, and he saw the prosperity of post-World War II years, and he said, "Hold my fucking beer." And that man was Ronald fucking Reagan. So by now we already know about Reaganomics. Lower taxes on the rich, and the resulting riches will trickle down to the masses. We also know that's a crock of shit. And this was just a piece of Reagan's overall economic plan, which involved drastic deregulation, decentralization, and privatization of massive industries that he decided were no longer the government's business. His policies did away with decades of government programs in the New Deal era that were meant to provide safety nets for more vulnerable populations. This meant an increase in poverty and a resulting increase in homelessness. His housing policy involved providing tax subsidies to underwrite the housing costs of rich people and the privatization of low-income housing development. Turning the low-income housing development over to the private sector was, of course, a non-solution, and he and his people knew it. There is little, if any, incentive in the private market to provide low-income housing. There is more money in housing the rich than in housing the poor. And this is basic economics 101. In a perfect free market, as demand goes up, the supply should also naturally go up as well. But demand is not the same thing as
need. There is a huge need for affordable housing. But for the free market to work, there must be demand, which is backed up by cash. Poor people don't have cash, so the market doesn't give a fuck about their needs. Their needs don't register in supply and demand because the market doesn't respond to anything that isn't backed up by cash. It's the literal reason why we need a government that protects the needs of the people that the free market leaves behind. And because of this ill-informed policy to privatize affordable housing, the federal government went from decades of direct intervention into the housing market to provide adequate supply for Americans to washing its hands of managing housing altogether. And it's held that stance ever since, leaving the development of housing in the hands of private enterprise and pretending that there's no precedent for the government to get involved. And Reagan's stance on the homeless population was similar to his adoption and promotion of the idea of welfare queens. It's their fault, not ours. At one press conference, he made this stance abundantly clear when he said that homeless people are, well, we might say, homeless by choice.
Yikes.
Along with this stance came a dramatic decline in HUD funding levels for subsidized housing assistance from $26.6 billion in 1980 to a paltry $7.4 billion in 1989. And by putting the power of housing development squarely in the hands of the under-regulated free market, Reagan opened the door on issues we're still seeing today, especially in the rapid gentrification of areas previously home to low-income households. That, combined with car-dependent city and suburban planning, means that low-income people are forced further and further outside of city centers to find affordable housing, requiring a working vehicle in order to then commute back into the cities that they've been priced out of in order to find work. When this isn't feasible for any number of reasons, and the people for whom housing has become unaffordable become homeless, they are then told by Reagan and every federal and local official since to just go somewhere else. And now the culmination of 40 years of housing privatization, compounded by the financial crisis of 2008, from which we learned very few lessons about the dangers of letting the free market run wild and toy with the homes and livelihoods of low-income Americans, has come to a head, spurred on by the destabilization across society that the COVID pandemic caused. Now we're seeing the massive stockpiling of land and properties by a handful of giant private investment companies whose short-sighted tactics include buying up apartment complexes, cutting corners, and raising rents, and then turning around and reselling at a profit, claiming they've improved the profitability of the building, when in reality they simply put people out of a home while making their notably shittier buildings more expensive to rent. But when those people then try to rent outside of the city, surprise, those investment firms have bought up townhomes and single-family houses too. So the rent is too damn high no matter where you turn, resulting in the current situation where literally 50% of the renting population is paying over 30% of their income in rent if they can even afford it at all. Not to mention the Airbnb bros who buy up properties to flip as Airbnbs, turning what was once meant to be a charming way to rent space from a local into yet another dystopian late-stage capitalism garbage bucket hellhole filled with poorly maintained scammy listings that once again profit from low-income people who are just trying to travel on a budget. And while the homelessness crisis is complex and multifaceted and everyone has a different story that can't be fixed by one band-aid solution, including unaddressed trauma, cycles of abuse and poverty, mental health and substance abuse issues, the number one obstacle to solving the homelessness crisis in America is a lack of affordable housing. Full stop. People are generally not homeless by choice. This is not a crisis of people out on the streets because they don't feel like working. There are many homeless people who are actively working, some of them more than one job, and they still can't afford the rent prices on top of the other associated costs with renting a home, like first and last month's rent and a security deposit. When I lived in Boston, I paid $2,000 per month for a two-bedroom in the most affordable neighborhood I could find that was also a reasonable commute to my law school. I split the cost with a roommate, but with the required first month, last month, security deposit, and broker's fee, we had to come up with $8,000 just to get into our shitty apartment. And $2,000 a month is incredibly affordable in Boston. This was 7 years ago, so Lord knows that same place is probably going for at least $2,500 a month now in Roxbury. And so these growing prices and dwindling affordable housing options means that we have reached a fever pitch where now local governments, not only in LA and New York, where a large portion of the homeless population in America lives, but also in small rural towns where homelessness is a newer issue, are feeling immense pressure to fix the homelessness problem in their cities. And they say, well, building affordable housing and shelter space takes too long, so we need other options. And those options are punishing homeless people for being homeless. The idea being that a tough love approach is the best way to get people to get their shit together and just stop being homeless already. And I love this idea of a tough love approach because we only ever apply that to poor people. You could argue that the Ninth Circuit rulings in Boise and Grants Pass requiring cities to come up with a better solution than just criminalizing the shit out of their homeless people is also tough love. You should have seen this housing shortage crisis coming from a mile away. It's been mounting for 40 years. Maybe get your shit together and figure it out or face steep fines and penalties. It's just a little tough love. Bootstrap yourselves already. But no, instead, local governments have developed an impressive playbook of varying ways to control, demean, and destroy homeless people in the hope that they'll just go away already. This includes destroying homeless encampments with little notice and before securing any alternative shelter for the people living inside, arresting anyone who interferes. Here in Minneapolis, they like to then place giant cement blocks in the encampment area so that no one can come back. This is happening across the country from LA to Minneapolis to DC, and flattening these encampments is a short-term solution that city council are using to try to appease the many angry residents who also just want homeless people to go away already. A Washington Post poll found that 75% of local DC residents backed shutting encampments down, and many local leaders say that the encampments make people think that nothing is being done about the homelessness problem, so demolishing them is the solution, instead of, I don't know, actually doing something that's a long-term solution and then getting better at communicating to your constituents what it is that you're doing. But that would take planning and foresight. It's much easier to bring in the bulldozer. But local officials do face very real consequences for these encampments. In Phoenix, citations for outdoor camping dropped dramatically after the Boise ruling in 2018, and more than 1,000 people have moved to a downtown encampment called The Zone. Local residents who disapprove of the encampment are suing officials over the situation. Meanwhile, a federal judge barred Phoenix from conducting encampment sweeps if there are no available shelter beds. This on top of the fact that voters are heavily influenced by seeing unhoused people on the streets and thinking that their officials aren't doing enough about it. So I can understand the difficult position that city officials are in. But shutting down encampments with no long-term solutions cannot be the answer. This is the tough love for cities. Just figure it out. But fines for sleeping in tents or on sidewalks are not the only way that homeless people are being criminalized in this country. And the other ways are a bit less obvious. For example, the United States is notably devoid of adequate public restrooms. There are only 8 per 100,000 people, the same number as in Botswana. Iceland leads the pack with 56 toilets per 100,000 people. Sleeping is necessary to sustain life, but so is using the restroom. It's a basic need, some would argue a basic human right, to use the bathroom with dignity. When you don't have a home, that becomes impossible, and relieving yourself on public streets is usually a chargeable offense and can even lead to indecent exposure charges that land you on the sex offender registry. And COVID only made matters worse, as the few public restrooms that were available were closed to prevent the spread of disease. And ironically, because of this lack of access to clean facilities, other diseases can run rampant, especially in encampments, like hepatitis A, which is spread through fecal matter. Poor sanitation policies tend to cost much, much more than just installing public toilets, requiring cities to spend tax dollars on everything from cleaning the sidewalks to treating disease outbreaks. And criminalizing people who have no other options creates further hurdles for them to claw their way out of their situation. Other methods of controlling and policing homelessness are less obvious than arrest and relocation. For centuries, urban design has been used to covertly control people, including the homeless population. For example, in Paris in the 1800s, city officials widened the traditionally narrow streets in order to allow the military more space to quash protests. In New York, the Long Island Southern State Parkway was strategically designed to pass under low stone bridges so that buses could never pass under them, making it more difficult for people who relied on public transportation, poor people, to visit the beaches that wealthier car owners could visit. Extremely bright lights in urban areas are designed to prevent crime and prevent homeless people from sleeping there. The LA Metro subway station blares classical music at all times to discourage people from sleeping or congregating inside the station. And then there's hostile architecture, designed meant to discourage loitering and public sleeping. The most common form of hostile architecture you see is in strategically designed benches. Those include slanted benches or leaning benches, benches so high that your legs hang off of them, making them uncomfortable to sit in for long, segmented benches or benches with armrests, curved benches, benches that lock, tiered benches, or the infamous Camden bench, designed so that the only comfortable way to use them is to sit on them. Other examples of hostile architecture include rocky or uneven pavement, street or doorway spikes, some of which are retractable, purposely created gaps in awnings so it's hard to find shelter underneath, barred corners, raised and spiked grate covers so someone can't lie on the grate and get heat from the subway below, fenced grate covers, boulders under bridges, graded or spiked pavement under highway overpasses, fences under overpasses, and strategically placed sprinklers. And the greatest irony is that these designs cost taxpayers tons of money, money that could be going towards actually helping homeless people. New York City's Metro Transit Authority spent $74 million installing leaning bars. Seattle spent $1.1 million to fence off the Spokane Street Viaduct. Miami spent $350,000 for 53 solar-powered lights to brightly illuminate a park all night, even though it closes at sunset. Spokane, Washington spent $150,000 to install rocks in an underpass, and San Diego spent $57,000 to do the same. Design, lighting, and architecture are used to build an environment hostile to people experiencing homelessness, just like every other part of our society is designed to be hostile to them as well. And it's not just the unhoused population that's being criminalized. Those trying to assist them also face criminal punishment. Many cities, including, for example, Houston, have created charitable feeding ordinances, which penalize the distribution of food. In 2014, a 90-year-old World War II veteran in Fort Lauderdale named Chef Arnold was arrested for serving meals in a public park, something he'd been doing for nearly 2 decades. Between 2013 and 2016, 26 cities passed food-sharing bans, and now advocates estimate that around 70 cities across the country have banned food sharing. City officials cite concerns over sanitation and public health, and instead of working with groups trying to solve the homelessness problem for them, cities are criminalizing their activities. Sanitation, safety, and public health are worthy causes to be concerned about, but criminalizing these activities instead of solving the reasons behind why people need to seek out free food to begin with, or defecate in public, or sleep on the streets, is short-sighted and immoral. And of course, where policies are short-sighted and immoral, you're likely to find conservative actors lining up to receive donations from the wealthy interests who benefit from those horrible policy solutions. Like I said, even nominally liberal cities are turning to draconian measures to police people experiencing homelessness in their communities. But you better bet the laws and policies are being shaped and developed by conservative actors. First, let's talk about housing. There isn't enough of it. And the housing that exists is being bought up by major investors who can turn around and make a profit off the rents they keep raising. Want to know the top spender of lobbying dollars in Washington in both 2020 and 2022 election cycles? The National Association of Realtors. They've had their lobbying fingies in every attempted housing reform bill to hit Congress for years. And then there's the think tanks. The Cicero Institution is an Austin-based organization whose model laws push for criminalization of sleeping on public land and have been adopted in at least half a dozen states. The Goldwater Institute, another conservative think tank, filed a brief in support of the plaintiff suing Phoenix over the Zone encampment. And these measures by theoretically academic think tanks further legitimize statements made by Ron DeSantis and Donald Trump, both of whom have proposed moving unhoused people to camps and tent cities outside of towns on inexpensive land. Another term for that is internment camps. Last I checked, we had collectively decided that those are bad. And meanwhile, Congress has done nothing. It hasn't increased HUD's budget, it hasn't attempted to regulate predatory landlords or end the monopoly that a few companies have on our housing, it hasn't attempted to increase access to housing vouchers, and it hasn't passed legislation to protect children from hunger and eviction. It doesn't even have a goal to do any of these things. Part of this has to do with underfunding. It also has to do with powerful lobbying interests buying out our politicians. But it also has to do with our collective dehumanization of people experiencing homelessness, and the general nature with which we as a society view homelessness. The criminalization of homelessness is the go-to policy solution and has been for centuries because homelessness is fundamentally understood as a problem of deviant, criminal, individual behavior, not as a problem with society at large. We see individuals as responsible for their homelessness, hence the Reagan line that people are homeless by choice. We think they didn't plan ahead, they didn't manage their money responsibly, they likely have drug addiction problems, which is also their fault, and therefore, they're on the streets because of their own bad criminal behavior. Reminder again that 63% of working adults say they couldn't handle a $500 emergency. There's not much standing between being housed and being homeless for a huge portion of people in this country. Does it really make sense to blame that on individual inability to save properly or work hard enough? Or at this scale, should we maybe start to question whether the system itself is fucked? But that's not really how we jive on anything criminal or crime adjacent in this country. Everything is an individual's problem. You're homeless because you're lazy or addicted to drugs. If you're in prison, that means you're a criminal, branded for life, incapable of rehabilitation. You're a bad person. That couldn't be me. Once again, this plays into the idea that America is full of people who think they're temporarily embarrassed millionaires, when in reality, most of us are one mistake or emergency away from financial ruin. And this affects how our elected officials govern because of their own biases, yes, but it also affects how they govern because the general public holds those biases as well. Again, 75% of DC residents are in favor of getting rid of homelessness. homeless encampments. We want problems to go away, and we assume that homeless individuals pose a serious risk to our own safety. This despite the fact that studies have shown that people experiencing homelessness are no more likely to engage in criminal activities than a housed person, except for breaking laws that criminalize their very existence in public. And in fact, people without shelter are at increased risk of being the victims of violent crimes themselves. But this pervasive myth that an unhoused person is inherently dangerous means that their criminalization is generally supported by the public at large. Not to mention the fact that visible homelessness affects the aesthetics of a city, which can depress property values. So powerful interests are pushing elected officials to make the problem disappear. Not to fix it, but to once again make the homeless people just go somewhere else. And so instead of addressing systemic deficiencies that lead to homelessness, specifically the lack of affordable housing, the blame is shifted to the individuals experiencing homelessness, many of whom have been failed by the system at multiple levels, facing discrimination for their race or gender expression or sexual orientation on top of the stigma, discrimination, and criminalization that comes from not being able to obtain housing. But the reality is that most states and localities don't have the capacity to fund the mass creation of affordable housing that's needed across the board. Or if they do, they also have very vocal and very powerful critics from within the business and housing development community pushing against regulations that would keep them from making the absolute most amount of money possible, and many wealthy residents are horrified at the idea that low-income or multifamily housing could encroach upon their beautiful undisturbed lives where they get to pretend that these problems don't exist. Very big inconvenience. But the federal government needs to step up as well. This country doesn't have a national housing policy. Because of its limited budget, HUD plays a very minor role in subsidizing housing for low-income people. Much of the work that the federal government does regarding housing affordability happens because of the Treasury Department and a little-known agency called the Federal Housing Finance Agency, which oversees incentives, credits, and subsidies meant to spur the creation of lower-income housing. It doesn't build housing, instead it makes mortgages cheaper and covers part of market rents to incentivize private companies to build more affordable housing. But the agency, which oversees Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, while having more practical authority over the housing market than HUD, doesn't view itself as a housing agency. They aren't sitting up there working on housing access issues. And that's a problem. HUD is basically a joke at this point. It's not much of a housing agency, and it doesn't do much urban development either. The current HUD secretary actively and publicly lobbied Joe Biden to give her a different cabinet position. Before her was Trump's HUD secretary, Ben Carson, a doctor with zero housing experience who repeatedly asked for his own budget to be cut. Most of the little budget HUD does have goes to its voucher programs, also known as Section 8 housing, which covers part of the recipient's rent. The problem is that these vouchers are incredibly difficult to get, and many applicants are stuck on waiting lists for years to get them. Once they do get them, they're often discriminated against by landlords who won't accept the vouchers. Unlike SNAP benefits or Medicaid coverage, which are entitlement programs, meaning that if you qualify, then you're entitled to receive the benefits, Section 8 is not an entitlement program. Most qualifying families don't get help. For comparison, 41 million Americans receive SNAP benefits. Only 5 million receive a Section 8 voucher. One reason why it's so difficult to regulate housing on a federal level is because land use is the purview of the states. The government can't regulate how states use their own land generally. So where most countries have one standard uniform housing code, the US has a patchwork of different regulations and no way for the national government to come in and create uniform rules. But there is a lot that the federal government could be doing that is within its purview. For example, the child tax credit expansion in 2021, which increased the amount of money a family received to support their children, led to a 46% decline in the child poverty rate in the US. Since that tax credit expired, child poverty is now higher than pre-pandemic levels. Tax credits like that, or the low-income housing tax credit, are powerful ways that the federal government can put money in the hands of people experiencing housing insecurity. The government could also direct more money to states experiencing high housing costs. It could also make Section 8 housing vouchers an entitlement program, so those who qualify actually receive it. The government could also fast-track skilled immigration to increase the number of construction workers available to build these houses. HUD could actually act like the policy expert it's meant to be by advising state and local governments on how to increase their housing supply, and by monitoring the innovative experimentation that's happening in some municipalities to see what works and expand that knowledge to other localities. No agency is doing this kind of work. And that's largely because the federal government doesn't see the housing crisis as the federal government's responsibility because of Reagan-era policies, but also because, say it with me, money and politics. Because the National Realtors Association and other powerful lobbying groups, they understand the power that Washington has in controlling housing development and policy. But our politicians are so bought out by big business that any policy attempting to regulate the housing industry is dead on arrival. So we need to get money out of our politics. But in the meantime, there are things that you can do to tangibly help people experiencing homelessness. First, you can donate to shelters in your area that are in desperate need of funding, as well as clothing, food, and personal care items. This video is a fundraiser for Simpson Housing Services, a local nonprofit shelter here in Minneapolis that assists 2,000 people experiencing homelessness every year, including providing emergency shelter and connecting families and individuals to affordable housing. You can donate here if you're able. You can also visit the website for the National Alliance to End Homelessness, which works at a national level to push for policy change. Go to the Take Action section of their website, where you can easily contact your representatives to push for greater funding in the fiscal year 2024 Transportation, Housing, and Urban Development Appropriations Bill. You can tell them to support the Housing Access Act as well, and you can sign up for advocacy alerts for bills and ordinances in your own state. The organization Housing Not Handcuffs has a map tracking proposed state laws that would further criminalize homelessness. Learn what's happening locally near you and how you can work to intervene on behalf of the rights of people experiencing homelessness. This is not a problem that's just going to go away with more policing and criminalization. It will take concerted efforts at every level of government to address the systemic failures that have led to this current housing crisis. Thank you to my Patreon community and my YouTube members for supporting the research and work that goes into these videos. Consider checking out my Patreon community or clicking the big join button below to become a member here on YouTube. You'll be supporting my work and getting access to special extra content. You can also get early access to next week's video, exclusive live streams, and so much more. The extra content is the same whether you join as a YouTube member or on Patreon. Your support helps to keep these videos free for everyone and further our mission towards legal and political education for all. Shout out to my newest supporters, as well as supporters in my royal tiers, and a very special shout out to my multi-platinum supporters, Joshua Cole, Thomas Johnson, Sophia Sams, Anthony Giles, and Brett Piantek. Your generosity makes this channel what it is, so thank you. If you liked this video, you'll probably also like my video all about how Trump and the GOP use fear to gain power and control. Thanks so much for watching. Have a good day. Bye-bye.